Welcome to The Latest on the Law, a podcast of the Boston Bar Association. The Commonwealth's premier legal association, the BBA, is home to over 15,000 members and 140 institutional partners consisting of law firms, corporations, government agencies, legal aid organizations, and law schools. Visit us at bostonbar.org to learn more.
So welcome, everybody. The title of our presentation today is The Voluntary Dissolution of a Massachusetts Nonprofit Organization. My name is Erin Whitney Cicchetti. I'm a partner in Nutter's tax department. I frequently work with charitable and other nonprofit organizations on issues related to their tax-exempt and nonprofit statuses, including formation, governance, compliance, and dissolution. So I'll turn it over to RG from the AG's office to introduce herself.
Hi, everybody, and thank you for being here on a Friday afternoon. My name is RG Cosmetato Shapiro. I'm one of a small group of attorneys in the Attorney General's offices, Public Charities Division, and we handle all charitable matters that come across our desk in Massachusetts from a regulatory standpoint, including transactions, a robust probate practice, trusts and estates, corporate dissolutions, which is the subject of today's presentation, and a lot of other related matters in the charities field. We look forward to presenting to you this afternoon. Thanks.
Perfect. So just to get things started, this presentation updates the article written by attorneys Regina S. Rockefeller and Tamara L. Sturges and published by the BBA Tax Exempt Committee of the BBA Business Law Section in the fall of 2009, and the PowerPoint slides created by Regina S. Rockefeller and distributed at the April 2013 BBA Tax Exempt Org section, session on dissolution of Massachusetts public charities.
The usual disclaimer. With respect to my office, the Office of the Attorney General's Office, the views and opinions expressed here are solely those of the presenters and not necessarily those of the Attorney General. They do not constitute official guidance from the Attorney General's Office and are not intended to serve as a statement of law or an official opinion. We have a substantial amount of official guidance documents available on our website. And as I will discuss during the presentation, with respect to dissolutions in particular, be aware that we have just revised our dissolutions guidance to reflect a new process for the filing of with asset dissolution complaints with the SJC, which I will discuss soon. For now, however, I'd like to start with a high-level discussion of the Attorney General's Office's statutory authority as it applies to dissolution of charitable entities. By statute, the division is charged with enforcing the due application of funds given or appropriated to public charities within the Commonwealth and preventing breaches of trust in the administration thereof. What does this mean? Next slide, please. This means that there's a distinction between a public charity, which this slide defines, and a nonprofit entity. Our jurisdiction is over public charities. From time to time, we do get questions from board members of nonprofit organizations about issues related to board governance and dissolution. Many nonprofit entities are not necessarily public charities. One example is a 501c7 social club whose mission is not charitable and does not benefit an indefinite portion of the public. If that entity is organized as a Chapter 180 corporation in Massachusetts, if they want to dissolve, they need to follow the requirements of Chapter 180, Section 11. But here, this presentation applies to voluntary dissolutions of charitable corporations under Chapter 180, Section 11A. Next slide, please. So the presentation focuses on the dissolution of charitable corporations. A different process applies when terminating charitable trusts. It's important to contact our office if you have a termination of a charitable trust, because that's a whole different other matter that deals with uniform trust code issues and the reading of the trust instrument. Courts look to us as well to have to make sure that we have done our due diligence and assent to the proposed termination of a charitable asset. But today we'll focus on dissolution of charitable corporations.
Okay, so when should a charity consider dissolution? Dissolution should be considered if donors are no longer able or willing to support the charity's mission, if merger and acquisition opportunities have been unfruitful, if volunteers are no longer committed to the organization, if finances appear to be irrevocably adverse, or if the mission is no longer relevant or serves a need. But before deciding to dissolve, a charity should consider its alternatives to dissolution. Dissolution is a lengthy process and shouldn't be taken lightly. And sometimes there's another route short of dissolution that addresses the charity's issues. So the first alternative that I will discuss is a merger or consolidation. And so this would be a merger or consolidation with a like-minded charity to achieve economies of scale and attract new clients, volunteers, and/or donors. So the charitable sector in Massachusetts has been fairly active in recent years in the mergers and acquisition space. Many charities have been looking to join efforts to, among other things, cut costs. So before deciding to dissolve, it may be worth exploring merger consolidation opportunities. But there are some obstacles to a merger or a consolidation as well to keep in mind. And just a note here that a merger is typically a transaction where one of the existing entities survives, and a consolidation is generally one in which a new entity is created. So as an example, in a merger, the liabilities of the non-surviving entity become the liabilities of the surviving entity. So diligence is extremely important. Employee and benefit transition matters can be complex and time-consuming as well. So if there are employees of either entities, you have to take those issues into account. And then you have to decide whether it will be treated as a merger of equals or if one entity will act as the surviving entity. So, you know, there are many more decisions that I won't touch upon today, but there are a lot of things to think through before going this route. So the second alternative I'll talk about is a voluntary reorganization by the charity that would otherwise dissolve. So here, as opposed to a merger or consolidation, you don't need to find a like-minded organization to combine with. A reorganization is simply going through some internal adjustments. The charity can make governance or programmatic adjustments. So, you know, it's helpful to think about what is causing the difficulties within the organization and whether there's any internal reorganization that they could go through to fix the issues. So one example is if an organization is seeing a revenue reduction from its programming, perhaps the organization can adjust its programming by adding new programs or adjusting the programs that already exist to better serve the need of the charitable class and to increase revenue. On the governance side, perhaps there are staffing issues that need to be addressed, like a new executive director. Or a lot of times organizations that I work with will go out to recruit new board members to help with fundraising. So the voluntary reorganization route can be one of a good first step because it's all internal and sometimes they can be, you know, among the most simple fixes. Okay, so of course there are substantial costs of a business wind down and dissolution. The trustees or directors must consider the substantial money that will be needed to dissolve in an orderly manner before all funds of the charity are spent on operations. The directors need to avoid spending the last dollars on operations. And there's a tension here between optimism and realistic decision-making. So for example, there will likely be legal and accounting fees associated with the dissolution. And you want to make sure that the charity dissolving has adequate reserves for those expenses. And these expenses are obviously a moving target. So it's always better to err on the side of caution here to make sure that you have enough at the end of the day. Okay, so let's assume that a charity has made the decision to dissolve. What's next? One of the first steps is auditing the funds to distinguish between restricted and unrestricted funds. If funds are restricted, you have to think through what are the applicable restrictions. If it's feasible, it's very helpful to use an independent auditing firm here. So generally, there are three types of funds, three buckets of funds. Two of these types are restricted and one type is unrestricted. Permanently restricted funds are restricted to a particular purpose, but there's no time limitation on the restriction. It's attached to those funds indefinitely. Temporarily restricted funds, on the other hand, are restricted only within a specific time frame. So once that time frame is over, the funds are no longer restricted. They become unrestricted funds. And of course, unrestricted funds can be used for any purpose that's in alignment with the charity's charitable purposes, as they are stated in its articles of organization. So you need to consider these restrictions when deciding where the funds will go. Generally, the restrictions will follow the funds. So in other words, the recipient will be bound by the restrictions unless the charity can reach the donor of the funds and have them agree to alter the restrictions or remove the restrictions. Okay, so some practical issues to address in dissolving. So you need to pay all legitimate debts down. You need to terminate contracts and leases, including equipment rentals. So you'll need to take an inventory of all the organization's contracts to see what, if anything, needs to be done to terminate those relationships. You need to return rented items, and you need to negotiate accounts payable with vendors. Okay. An important decision.
Can I just interject? I'm sorry. I just want to make a point that the Attorney General's office, oftentimes when we're reviewing these dissolution, particularly the with asset dissolution complaints that go before the court, we will not assent to the relief requested with a with asset dissolution complaint if the outstanding debts have not been paid. So I just wanted to throw that out there. Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Thank you. So another important decision point in the dissolution process, and arguably the most important decision point, is choosing the asset recipient or recipients. The entity or entities to which the assets of the dissolving organization are to be transferred must, one, have a charitable purpose similar to that of the dissolving organization, or two, must agree to use the assets in accordance with the dissolving organization's charitable purpose, again, as it's written in the articles of organization. So this is a very important point that you'll probably hear us remind you of throughout the presentation. And it's one that the AG's office and the court will look at closely in their review. Relatedly, you need to consider whether any new restrictions should be attached to the transferred charitable assets and to make sure that the recipient organizations are going to abide by those restrictions. If the charitable purposes are not similar enough between the dissolving entity and the recipient entity, then the assets must be restricted to be used only for the dissolving charity's charitable purposes. So one easy example to conceptualize is if a dissolving organization's focus is on a particular geographic area, but the recipient organization has a broader reach, then the dissolving charity can restrict the use of the funds to that specific geographic area when it's transferring them over. Just a quick point here that beware of attaching restrictions for purposes of frustrating creditors. The board can't take a vote to shield assets from creditors, and you can't get rid of assets if a known liability is out there. Okay, I'll turn it back over to you, Argy.
Thanks, Erin. There are two types of dissolutions in general. There's voluntary dissolutions and involuntary dissolutions. And what you should know is that both require the close involvement of the charities division. If the charity has assets, the approval of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, the single justice, is required. For with asset dissolution, and that's because with asset dissolutions in particular, that go before the court, the single justice looks to the Attorney General's office for its assent to the relief requested in the complaint and trusts that the Attorney General's office has done its due diligence in reviewing the circumstances that led to the board's decision to dissolve and that the appropriate recipient of the dissolving a proposed recipient of the dissolving charity's assets is aligned with the mission of the dissolving charity. I'm going to talk about involuntary dissolutions first, only because I'd like to spend more time on the voluntary with asset dissolutions. Involuntary dissolutions are pretty rare. They're initiated by the Attorney General's office and they're governed by statute. In essence, the Attorney General's office will submit a petition to the Supreme Judicial Court seeking involuntary dissolution in two circumstances. If the charity has failed to file its annual submissions to the division for two consecutive years, or the Attorney General's office is satisfied that the charity has become inactive and that its dissolution would be in the public interest. If a charity, if a charity is out of compliance with its annual filing requirements, the division will typically send notice to the charity asking its board to submit its filings. I believe it's within 30 days. I can't double check on that, but the notice warns of penalties for failure to comply. We try to work with charities to help get them into compliance. We want them to succeed because they provide important public services to the people of Massachusetts. But sometimes there are those circumstances that, despite our warnings and efforts to help get these charities into compliance, we're going to need to involuntarily dissolve them. Erin, could you go to the next slide, please? Thanks. So that's all I'll say for now on involuntary dissolutions. It's pretty rare. For voluntary dissolutions, which is the bread and butter of a lot of what we do, the charity comes to us and initiates a dissolution. And there are two types of voluntary dissolutions, administrative and which are the no asset dissolutions, where a charity doesn't have assets, and judicially approved dissolutions where the charity has remaining assets. For voluntary dissolutions, and this applies to both administrative and judicial dissolutions, the charity initiates. It's governed by the statute, Section 11A. It requires an affirmative vote of the majority of the governing board of trustees or directors. And one very important practice tip that I encourage practitioners to do and to consider is to reach out to the Attorney General's office, to any one of our attorneys, to discuss the circumstances that led to the charity's decision to dissolve. This particularly is very important with respect to those dissolutions that will go before the single justice. And it's helpful to do that before drafting the complaint and certainly before filing it with the court, because in order to file it with the court, as I'll explain, you need the Attorney General's office's assent, and even with the administrative dissolutions. Next slide, please. So as I mentioned, there's two types of dissolutions, administrative for charities without assets and judicial that go before the Supreme Judicial Court, single justice, for charities with assets. Under the statute, if a charity has any remaining assets, you need to go before the court and seek the court's approval. With asset dissolutions, we are in a position to offer guidance, and our website offers some templates for practitioners, which have been revised recently, and to reflect the discussions that we have had with the clerk of the single justice. and I will talk about those changes. They're very minor changes, but it affects the way the complaint is captioned. I will emphasize the importance of seeking court approval before. Erin, can you go to the next slide, please? Okay, so with this slide, it's very important to emphasize that with respect to a charity that is looking to dissolve with assets, it's important to seek court approval and the assent of the Attorney General's office before transferring those assets to another charity. That is required by statute. And I say this and emphasize this because from time to time, we will get a charity. I'll give the example of a church whose board, for whatever reason, voted to dissolve and transferred assets before coming to us prematurely. And then, you know, we get a dissolution complaint where we find out that assets were transferred. What is it to do in that particular scenario that could have been avoided if somebody had reached out to us for guidance or reviewed our dissolution page on our website? The single justice looks to the Attorney General for its assent. And because of our statutory authority over all charitable assets in the Commonwealth, it's also much harder to claw back charitable assets in a circumstance where a transfer was inappropriate. An example, of course, would be where the recipient charity's mission and purposes doesn't align at all with that of the dissolving charity. So another practice tip is to make sure that the recipient charity's mission is as near as possible to that of the dissolving entity. I think I'd like to spend some time talking about the structure of the complaint with assets dissolutions. Following discussions with the clerk of the single justice, we have implemented this a revised process and have updated our website, as I mentioned before. Slide 19 describes who the parties to the dissolution will be in a dissolution complaint. It used to be that the complaint had to name the dissolving charity, the Attorney General, and the recipient entities as parties. Now, however, only two parties need to be named in the caption of the complaint. It's the dissolving charity and the Attorney General. The proposed recipient charities should be named in the body of the complaint as other interested parties. And I'll come back to that a little bit later. Erin, I'll turn it over to you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, so turning to the process of dissolution, the first step is to, and we've already briefly touched upon this, but it's to confirm and or achieve compliance with all registration and filing requirements. So there are a few ways that you can verify your charitable organization's status. You can check the division's website. You can check your own records, of course. And you want to make sure, again, that it's registered and it's submitted complete annual reports to the AG's office. So this is the Form PC and all appropriate attachments. If you're unsure about your status, you can certainly call the division to check the compliance status. RG, did you want to say something here?
I did. Thank you. I'm sorry. I just wanted to interject to remind folks that the division, in addition to the outstanding liabilities, to the extent that there are any, the division will not assent to the relief requested in a dissolution complaint or administratively dissolve a charity if the dissolving charity's filings are not up to date. It's very important the compliance issues be taken care of first. Thanks, Erin.
Yeah, of course. If you're missing anything, you have to get that filed before going forward. So there are certain organizations that are exempt from filing with the division pursuant to General Laws Chapter 12, Section 8F. A church is an example of an exempt organization. So these organizations generally must file instead a financial affidavit summarizing the organization's financial activities for the prior 3 years. So the next step in the process is to take the required board action. So you have to ensure that your organization has complied with the notice and voting requirements for dissolving under General Laws Chapter 180, Section 11, Capital A, B. Generally, before dissolving, you need a majority vote of the board. You also need to generate an officer's certificate attesting to the board action and its adequacy. There's a sample officer certificate on the division's website that you can use as a starting point. And just one more reminder here that the entity or entities to which the assets are to be transferred must have a charitable purpose similar to that of the dissolving organization, or must agree to use the assets in accordance with the dissolving organization's charitable purpose. The officer's certificate should specify the receiving entity and or entities and articulate whether the assets or property are to be used for the organization's general purposes, as stated in the articles, or whether they are going to be restricted to ensure that they're used in conformance with the dissolving organization's charitable purposes. So the next step is to complete the final Form PC. You'll hear it referred to as the Form PCF. So any organization that's required otherwise to report to the division must complete and submit this form. And as with all the other forms we're discussing today, there's a sample of this one on the division's website. Typically, the charitable organization's accountant, if it has one, is the one to handle the filing of this form. Organizations that aren't otherwise required to report to the AGO, such as churches, do not need to submit a final Form PCF. And then also just a quick accounting note here that the Form PCF is not for a full fiscal year. So to provide an example, if we assume that a charity is submitting its dissolution package this month, April 2024, it would owe both a full 2023 Form PC and then a final Form PC for January 1, 2024 through the submission date. So this would be a stub year. So, you know, there's one additional form than you might initially imagine when going through this process. So with the final Form PC, there's no need to include a filing fee, the federal information return, so the Form 990 or Form 990-PF, or audited or reviewed financial statements. These are generally included in yearly Form PC filings. You know, just a note here that the division, of course, reserves the right to require additional information if necessary or appropriate for its review. And, you know, based on personal experience, I have had back and forth with the division on financial information with regard to dissolutions in the past. I think it's very normal for the process to be iterative and for additional information to be requested with the goal of making the court process as streamlined as possible. And then another financial-based form is the dissolution worksheet. So this form summarizes at a high level the charity's financial activities for the previous four fiscal years. Again, the sample's on the website. And again, in my experience, the accountant is typically the one that handles the filing of this form. The financial data in the dissolution worksheet should generally match up with what's provided in the final Form PC. And in the previous Form PCs filed. Okay, so step five is preparing the complaint document and the accompanying documents. So we have the dissolution complaint, and that sets forth the reasons for the dissolution and where the assets are going. There's a motion for entry of interlocutory order. And basically this motion is asking the court for permission to transfer the assets and wind down the charity. And then the other document is a proposed order for the court to enter to allow for the transfer of the assets and winding down. So when the court receives this proposed order, they can either fully adopt it or they can make adjustments before issuing the interlocutory order. So as we've, RJ's previously mentioned, in the past, the parties to the complaint included the dissolving charity, the AG, and the recipient charity or charities. The updated process only has the dissolving charity and the AG as parties, and the recipient charity or charities are listed as interested parties. So updated samples reflecting this revised process are available on the division's website. But just a cautionary note here that these aren't simply fill in the blank forms, and it's tempting to simply fill in the blank when you look at them, but they must be tailored to the organization's specific circumstances. So they're meant to be kind of guidelines on what needs to be submitted, but you shouldn't just fill in the blanks and send it off. The complaint needs to include all relevant facts related to the organization's dissolution and the transfer of its remaining assets. It needs to state the parties, and it needs to state the dissolving charities and the recipient charities, charitable purposes. It needs to state the grounds for dissolution. And then it needs to request the transfer of the funds from to another charity for a similar charitable purpose. You should think, very carefully about where the funds will be going. And again, make sure those purposes align. It's important to make your case for the recipient charity. Why is the recipient charity the appropriate recipient of the assets? In my experience, I find that there's a bit of a heavier burden if the recipient charity is out of state. You should provide a thorough explanation of why there's no option within Massachusetts and why the funds are leaving Massachusetts. And I think that goes to, but RG, correct me if I'm wrong, the funds will be going outside of your jurisdiction. So you need to, ensure that they'll be used for proper purposes once they do so.
Absolutely, Erin. And as you mentioned earlier, this is an iterative process. If we get a dissolution complaint in great shape, we'll be able to then, discuss the process and what led to the dissolution and assent quick and be able to ask the office to authorize us to assent much quicker. So, as opposed to filling in the blank, the complaint really should be tailored to the facts and circumstances of the dissolving charity situation. So, to add to what you had suggested, it's what's the charity's mission? How did it operate and carry out mm-hmm. that mission? What are the circumstances that prompted its board to dissolve, like a school that closed, for example, or a church that closed? What are the remaining assets? Are there any debts remaining? Have they been satisfied? If there are, what is the dissolving charity proposing to do with the assets? Who are the recipient entities? Why were they chosen? How does their mission align with the dissolving charity's mission? What will the recipient entity use the funds for? And it's important to add that if the dissolving charity did something like transfer funds before coming to the Attorney General's office with the dissolution complaint, it must do a mea culpa. It should explain that to the court in the body of the complaint. This is why this is an iterative process. When did the transfer happen? How were the recipient entities chosen? Does the transfer meet CyPRE principles? Why should the court ratify the transfer? And I need to, emphasize that when you're counseling your charity to dissolve, the best course of action is to wait to counsel them to wait to transfer, obviously, the assets, because the court frowns upon and we frown upon assets that were transferred beforehand. So that's what I wanted to add.
Yeah, no, thank you. That's very helpful. I do see a few questions popping up. Some we will answer live and others we will just address right at the end of the presentation. So we see them in we will get to them. Okay. I also just wanted to note that I more often than not, I find that the judgment by the court is just simply on the papers, on the pleadings, and no appearance in court is necessary. However, I have seen a case where the judge asked the parties, so the dissolving charity's attorney or the dissolving charity and the AG's office, to come into court and answer questions because the assets were leaving the state. So, it's not unheard of to have to actually make an appearance in these type of cases. And one more point on, another example where perhaps the burden is heavier is when the transfer is to a donor advised fund. So the court and AG's office will be focused on how the funds will be spent by the donor advised fund. I think in large part because the charitable purposes of a donor advised fund are so broad that you want to make sure that the dissolving charity's charitable purposes are being carried forward. The complaint must also state the approximate assets and liabilities of the transferring charity. And again, from experience, I think you should make sure that the language of the complaint lines up with the language of the interlocutory order, and specifically that the purposes for which the recipients will use the assets line up. So you have to include certain information in multiple documents. So just make sure that you're being consistent across documents. So one question I saw in the chat is whether the samples will be updated on the division's website, and they have already been updated. So here's just a screenshot of the updated complaint for voluntary dissolution. Again, it's available on the website. So you'll see only the Attorney General's office is listed as a defendant. And then you can start to see what the complaint should include.
And you know, Erin, I'd like to add for practitioners that if, you know, in the process that's iterative, you reach out to us to discuss the complaint before you start drafting it, we often provide other samples from cases that we have done that have been decided. So it depends on the fact pattern, right? So we're happy to do that. We're happy to talk to folks. So please feel free to reach out to us.
Yeah, and RG, before I turn it over to you, I do see that the question was clarified that the complaint has been updated, but is the motion for entry of interlocutory order going to be updated as well if it has not already been?
Okay. Yes, perfect. I will make a note of that. This change happened within the space of a week, the past week. So yes,
groundbreaking.
2 days ago. So we're still, thank you for pointing that out. And if anybody sees anything else that needs to be updated, we welcome your suggestions.
Thank you.
Okay, is it my turn?
I think so.
Thanks. All right. So the additional step that that we need to talk about is step six. When you're submitting after the iterative process and you're ready to draft your you have drafted your dissolution complaint, you've made sure that your filing, the charity's filings are up to date, that the liabilities have been paid. The package that you need to submit to our office must include any exhibits. We'd like PDF copies of exhibits. Makes it easier for us to work with our internal workflow to submit it electronically so that we can get authorization when we're ready to do that, to assent. Any exhibits to the complaint, the completed form PCF, the officer certificate detailing the vote on which the decision to dissolve and transfer assets to which remaining proposed recipients was held, a dissolution worksheet. With the dissolution worksheet, make sure that the numbers work from your financial statements, that the numbers are accurate, because oftentimes our compliance analysts are our front line and review the dissolution worksheet to make sure the figures add up. Also, a draft of a motion for entry of interlocutory relief and a proposed interlocutory relief. And I think slide 29 is a little bit duplicative, because that's what will go to the court. To the court, once we have reviewed the packet that you've submitted to our office and we're ready to assent to the relief requested, we sign the motion for entry of interlocutory judgment. And you will then submit the complaint for voluntary dissolution with the attached exhibits, the motion for entry of interlocutory order, and the proposed interlocutory order. The other materials, such as the PCF form and the dissolution worksheet, are stay with the Attorney General's office as part of the file on this case. They don't get submitted to the court. Erin, next slide, please. Once, and again, this is a bit repetitive, but it's step by step. Once you receive our assent and the accompanying documents, I'm not sure what that means. It's our assent, and I guess it's the signature on the motion for entry of interlocutory order. You file the complaint, the motion for interlocutory order, and the proposed interlocutory order with the SJC, the single justice, along with the filing fee. And it's all through e-file. And the e-file requirements can be found on this website in the slide. And finally, the single justice. So there's the single justice will review the pleadings. And if the single justice is satisfied that everything's in order, the paperwork, the complaint makes the arguments it needs to make, it will authorize the transfer of assets through issuing an interlocutory order that you have given to the court asking for that authorization to transfer. I note that the charity may transfer, and this goes to what I have said before, it may only transfer its assets and or any property after the SJC issues the interlocutory order. It becomes problematic when assets have been transferred before that. Erin, I'll turn it over to you.
Perfect. So once you have the interlocutory order, it's time to pay down the debts of the dissolving charity and transfer the assets, as RG said. So the transfer of the remaining assets and after the payment of all debts needs to be in accordance with the interlocutory order. So for example, the interlocutory order might outline some restrictions that the assets must be subject to. So you need to transfer them in accordance with that. After the transfer, there's another set of documents to prepare. And this includes an affidavit of compliance. And this is signed by an officer of the dissolving organization. And it must include what assets were transferred and when. This document certifies to the court that the assets were transferred in accordance with the interlocutory order. There's also, on the flip side, there's an affidavit of receipt, which is signed by an officer of the organization or organizations receiving the assets. And again, this indicates much of the same information, you know, the type of assets, the value of the assets, and the date of receipt. These affidavits must include all information relating to the transfer. And at this point, you'll have a docket number from the SJC to include on those submissions. I'll turn it back over to you, RG.
Thanks. And I want to make a few points here because so the interlocutory order does not dissolve the charity. I want to emphasize that. It only authorizes the dissolving charity to transfer its remaining assets. And I mention this because from time to time, we will get a notice of dismissal from the single justice for a dissolution complaint done like a year ago. Where the court issued an interlocutory order authorizing the transfer may have been done of the assets, probably was done, usually was done, but the dissolving charity, for whatever reason, doesn't ask the court, then it doesn't take the next step and ask the court to issue a final judgment, formally dissolving the charity. So the next step requires the dissolving charity to come to us again and request our assent to the entry of judgment. And the way to do that is to, after the assets have been transferred, for our office, we need an affidavit of compliance and an affidavit of receipt. Those two affidavits must mirror each other. One, the affidavit of compliance is, I, you know, so-and-so, treasurer of so-and-so dissolving charity, on such and such a day transferred X amount to blah, blah. The affidavit of receipt, I so-and-so of this charity received on such and such a date from dissolving charity X amount. So they must mirror each other. So we need those affidavits and a motion for entry of judgment. I think we need a proposed judgment. Probably yes. Just the motion for entry. Yeah, we need a proposed judgment. We sign the motion for entry of judgment. The division will assent to the motion for entry judgment, is what I wanted to say. So the proposed judgment recites, and we have samples, the receipt of the affidavits of compliance and receipt recites that the recipient organization is the successor to the transfer's funds, property, assets, or interests for the purposes specified in the interlocutory order. Samples of these documents are available on our website. And then, you know, you file that final package with the SJC, and after the SJC reviews the documents and assuming that everything is in order, the Attorney General's office will sign the motion for entry of judgment. You'll file it with the SJC, and then you wait for a final order basically saying dissolved. And the next step, we filed the documents, notice of docket entry, you will get that, and a judgment declaring that the charity is dissolved. At that point, the charity ceases to exist in Massachusetts. And the final step, don't forget, is going to the Secretary of the Commonwealth and notifying them that the court has dissolved the charity and attaching a copy of the final judgment. Administrative dissolutions. I'm going to briefly touch upon these because administrative dissolutions by statute authorize, the division by statute is authorized to dissolve charitable nonprofit corporations with no remaining assets. This type of dissolution is only allowed for organizations that either never operated or received any funds whatsoever, they currently have no remaining funds, or they will have no remaining funds or property after they pay off their debts. This includes costs associated with their windup and dissolution. Important to note, unless you're a grant maker, unless the charity is a grant maker, charity may not spend down its assets by giving away its property. That type of grant making has to already be part of the charity's purpose and operations. The division will not administratively dissolve charities that engage in self-help. So as I have mentioned before, guidance is available on our website. We are updating the website, in the process of further updating. So administrative dissolutions, step one, make sure, again, for judicial dissolutions, the same thing, compliance. Make sure your filings, your client's filings are up to date. Make sure that a board certificate of board vote is submitted to our office, a form PCF, a dissolution worksheet, an administrative dissolution petition. Again, that's available on our website. We have a sample here in this presentation. Submit package to the dissolution. You have to submit the administrative dissolution petition, the dissolution worksheet, the form PCF if it's required, the officer certificate, and sign and date. Don't forget to sign and date your administrative dissolution petition. And then notify the Secretary of the Commonwealth, or if you need to, the IRS, whatever agency you need to notify. And this is a sample of a template.
Okay, so I will go through the rest of these slides fairly quickly so that we have a few minutes at the end to answer the outstanding questions. Before I dove into these, I just wanted to emphasize the point about no self-help. I can't tell you how many times, I've had organizations come to me and kind of, just ask questions about that route, distributing out the funds and then going the no asset dissolution route. So it's really important that you go through the appropriate process if you have assets left to dissolve. So just some, final practical issues to consider. You could consider using an accounting firm to pay payables and collect receivables during the dissolution and after employees have left for other jobs. You could, of course, retain a law firm to handle the dissolution and the oversight of the pending litigation. Any money that comes into the organization after the closure of operations just generally must follow where the other funds will go. You should consider severance to retain employees until the safe closure of operations. There's usually work to be done right up until the legal dissolution. You have to notify terminated employees of any post-termination benefits, if any. I am not an employment lawyer, but there are COBRA issues and unemployment issues to consider here. You have to think through which records must be retained and for how long and by whom. And beware of confidentiality concerns in the record transfer process. Again, I'm not an employment lawyer, but there are WARN Act and Department of Unemployment Insurance requirements to think through for the termination of employees. And there are special requirements that we won't get into today for hospital closures. And finally, just thinking through things on the IRS side, you need to prepare a final Form 990, Form 990EZ, 990N, or 990PF if you're a private foundation. Again, these forms are typically handled by accountants. They are due no later than 4 months and 15 days after the dissolution order. I think there is sometimes some confusion about this due date. So it's not your typical May 15th due date if you're a calendar year tax calendar year organization. It's once you get that dissolution order, the clock starts ticking on that 4.5 month window. On the 990 and similar forms, you need to indicate that it's a final return. And then with the Form 990 or Form 990EZ, you have to also file a Schedule N and include a certified copy of the articles of dissolution or resolutions of the governing board approving the dissolution. Okay, so I'm just going to leave up on the screen here our contact information, but there are some outstanding questions. I think, RG, if you want to, do you think they're directed maybe towards you?
Thank you, Erin. So the first question is, how long is it generally taking the division to review and process asset and no asset dissolutions currently? That depends. If everything is in order and the packet is, so administrative dissolutions, they can go very quickly. We have some folks who are dedicated to reviewing those and getting those out pretty quickly. I would say it would average about a month or two. But again, it depends on, oftentimes when we get the no asset dissolution, there's something wrong with the administrative petition, or the numbers are off on the dissolution worksheet, or the officer certificate, there's something wrong with the filings, or when the filings are not up to date. So if all of those things are, aligned, then the process goes by quicker. For the with asset dissolutions, generally we are looking at, a couple of weeks it depends on the queue, what's in the queue. And it depends on the facts and circumstances of the dissolution. No with asset dissolution has the same facts and circumstances. Some are simple, some are complicated. But I can tell you that once everything is in order and we submit to you submit to the single justice, they're pretty quick about turning it around. So, we've had a single justice issue a decision, issue the judgment, or even the interlocutory order within 2 days recently. So so just make sure you reach out to our office. It is an iterative process. The more we discuss, the more you can get the dissolution complaint and the substance of it together. the better off the process and speedier it would be. The next question I had is, can you please confirm when and how the recipient charity needs to receive notice of the complaint, et cetera? What proof will the Attorney General's office be looking for? Good question. Since now the recipient charities ought to be named in the complaint as interested parties, they really should be, I think the best way is to serve them and attach a certificate of service showing the court that you've served them. But you could reach out, you know, we will have that on our guidance if we don't have that already, but I'll make sure that I include that in our list of things to update. But I think if you do a certificate of service, I think that that's adequate to ensure that the recipient entities receive notice of the complaint.
The BBA is Boston's largest legal network built on justice, community, education, and inclusion. Take advantage of our exclusive Express membership offer and save 50% off BBA membership through August 31st, 2024. Enjoy the full benefits of BBA membership and take advantage of BBA programs and events, discounts on services, access to the full Learn Online library, and much more. This special offer is only available through March 15th, 2024. Use code EXPRESS50 at checkout.